This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Humans of Space, a podcast from the makers of BBC Sky Night magazine and hosted by Niamh Shaw that looks at the individuals who shape our understanding of the universe and how they got to be where they are today. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skynightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
We're speaking today with Jeff Hoffman, former NASA astronaut and professor in aeronautics and astronautics at MIT in the United States. So, hello, Jeff. How are you? Thank you so much for joining me on the Humans of Space podcast. I've been chasing you for a few years now. I think I asked you back in 2017 for an interview, but between one thing and another, I don't think I was available. And then we were together on the Space Studies program, and unfortunately then you'd left site by then. So we finally did it. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, Niamh, it's a pleasure. We've had contact over the years. We just never actually got to sit down and do this. So I'm happy that we can finally do it and share some interesting stuff with our listeners.
Yeah, no, it's terrific and it's great. And we were just talking there before we started recording. You know, I was telling you that this series is now on the BBC Sky at Night website, and you told me a little segue of a story. So, you know, tell me about your experience with the amazing Sir Patrick Moore.
I actually was on the original television Sky at Night with Patrick Moore, Sir Patrick Moore. Both in relatively early days, and then even towards the end when he was ailing. What an incredible person. I mean, I guess he had the longest continual running show in BBC history is what everybody used to say. And he was he inspired so many people just to stop and look up and see what's up there in the sky. And it's a wonderful be a source of inspiration. And he was a real trooper. I mean, I remember the last time that I worked with him, he was already ailing, and we actually went down to his home on the South Coast, and the BBC had set up a television studio basically in his home so that we could record. And, you know, he was kind of had a hard time getting around, but as soon as you put the microphone in his hand, he was the old Patrick Moore, and that's the mark of a real professional. It was a pleasure working with him, and a real loss when he finally passed away.
Yeah, he's sorely missed. I mean, he inspired so many of us. You know, as a child, for all of us, we would watch that on BBC. Anybody interested in space, we would watch that. I didn't really understand a lot of what I was watching, but his enthusiasm would always make me, you know, to stay on and keep with them. He was great, absolutely great. So that's lovely that you met him, Jeff. That's amazing. And you did that, of course. You spent some time in the University of Leicester. Are you still connected in some way to the University of Leicester?
Well, I spent 3.5 years continuously at Leicester after I got my doctorate. I was actually only planning to spend a year, but I met a very nice woman who eventually became my wife.
And
instead of 1 year in the UK, I came back to the US 3.5 years later with a wife and a 10-week-old son. So that certainly changed my life. And I stayed in contact with the university over the years. While I was an astronaut, I made every couple of years I would come over and give a talk about the various flights I had done. And then after I left the astronaut program, and I'm now a professor at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it turned out that the university decided they wanted to put on a short course in human spaceflight and asked if I would like to teach it. So for about 10 years, I would go over for a couple of weeks every fall and teach the course. course. And unfortunately, my life has become a lot busier with my Mars experiment and other things. And I unfortunately couldn't continue to do that. But I still have a lot of friends in Leicester and look forward to getting back there one of these days.
That's great. Did you ever visit the Space Center, the National Space Center there?
Oh, absolutely. I cut the ribbon when it was inaugurated.
Oh, brilliant.
I was there I've been back there on several occasions. And now, of course, they have a big science park and really made great progress. It's a real great facility, both for students and also for researchers. So it's really, and of course, Leicester is pretty centrally located, so people from all over the country have access to it. And it's a really a great asset for education and for research.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's terrific. Well, I'm delighted that you have this connection already to Sky at Night and Leicester and everything. So it's fantastic that we waited until now, because this current series is on that website. So Jeff, you've had an incredible career, and a lot of what this podcast really is about, I love having conversations with people about how they have formed the life that they've had, and it's always really nice to go back to, with that conversation, to go back to the beginning. So you grew up in New York, and I know you did your PhD in Harvard. So how did you manage to make that happen? Who were the people along the way that you would say helped you achieve something, which is quite incredible?
Well, rather than attribute it to a person, I'd actually like to give thanks to a machine, which is the planetarium projector at the New York Hayden Planetarium, because my parents, they would take me to a lot of museums and cultural events in New York City, as I was growing up, and there was something about the planetarium which just fascinated me. They had this big stereopticon projector. I mean, it was the old-fashioned one with analog optics, and nowadays they have digital projectors, which are fantastic, but they don't have that science fiction-y look that the old Hayden Planetarium projector had. And somehow there was something about the stars, and of course you couldn't see very many stars from New York City, but I learned all the constellations, and I remember my dad took me to, they had an orrery where you could look at the motion of the planets and explain to me retrograde motion of the planets. And I was just always fascinated by astronomy. At the same time, I was a little boy back in the 1950s before Sputnik was launched, and it was really the birth of the space age. But even before Sputnik, there was a lot of talk about the coming of the space age, and the newspaper articles, magazines, television shows, and then of course Sputnik was launched, and everybody got excited about that, and then, who was going to put the first human in space. And, I remember Yuri Gagarin and Alan Shepard and John Glenn. And of course, like every red-blooded American boy, I thought, gee, I'd love to be an astronaut. And of course, back then it wasn't available for girls. Now, luckily, girls could dream of being astronauts as well. But in any case, it became apparent pretty soon that all of these astronauts were military pilots, and that was not a career that I aspired to. So although I was always fascinated by the space program, and I followed it very closely, through Mercury, Gemini, the Apollo flights, I was in high school and college and university, but I pursued my interest in astronomy, and because of my interest in space, it turned out that this was really also, in addition to being the early days of human space flight, it was the early days of doing astronomy from space. And that interested me because, every time you look at the universe in new wavelengths, first we could only look at regular light. And then back in the 30s, Karl Jansky discovered there were radio waves coming from the sky. And so radio astronomy was born, and we had a whole new view of the universe. And then finally, when we had the ability to go up above the atmosphere, we could look at X-rays and gamma rays. And to me, that represented a really exciting opportunity because I knew, you know, this was something new. Nobody had ever done this before. And so I got interested in X-ray astronomy. That's why I came over to the University of Leicester, because they had and continue to have a world-class X-ray astronomy group. I spent 3.5 years at Leicester, went back to MIT. We had an X-ray satellite, and we had some fascinating discoveries of what we call X-ray bursts, which are thermonuclear explosions on the surface of neutron stars. Again, something completely new and unexpected. So I had a very exciting early scientific career. And continued to follow the space program, which by then, of course, Apollo had ended. We had flown Skylab, Apollo Soyuz, and NASA at that point, we're now in the mid to late 1970s, NASA was developing what was then the brand new space shuttle. And the thing about the space shuttle was you could have a crew of 7 people, but you only needed 2 pilots. And that's what really opened things up for scientists, engineers, medical doctors. So, you know, I was happy working as an astronomer, getting ready to look for a position as a professor somewhere in academia, when I saw an announcement from NASA that, hey, we're looking for astronauts for this new space shuttle. And by the way, yes, we still want pilots, but we also want scientists, engineers, medical doctors. And, this had been a dream since childhood of actually going into space. I mean, my childhood heroes, you asked who interested me, who influenced me. It was Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and Tom Corbett's Space Cadet. You know, it was these science fiction heroes that I thought, you know, this is really cool what these guys are doing. Not that I ever considered it a realistic career, because as I said, I was not a military pilot, but when the opportunity opened up with the space shuttle, I put in my application along with 8,000 other people and I was lucky enough to get selected. And of course that changed my life for the next 20 years. I was a NASA astronaut and ended up making 5 flights in the space shuttle including the rescue and repair of the Hubble Space Telescope. So in the end, you know, I might say that maybe I did more good for astronomy by being an astronaut and fixing Hubble than I ever would have done if I had remained a professional astronomer. But there you are. You never know where life is going to take you. I was very fortunate to have had an opportunity and took advantage of it. And here we are.
You've just summarized so much in that I have to go back and unpack a lot of it, but it is an incredible trajectory that you had. So if we go all the way back, so when you were young and you saw Sputnik, what was that like? You know, because as you say, you were reading comments like Flash Gordon and all these science fiction, and then it actually was happening in real time around you. When Sputnik launched, what was that like on the ground? Like, what were the kind of conversations, or how did it suddenly go from becoming something tangible for you, observing that happen around you?
There were two aspects of Sputnik. First of all, we were in the middle of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. And one of the reasons why the space technology and human spaceflight advanced so rapidly, it became kind of an ersatz or a proxy for a real war, which, you know, is much better to compete by sending, you know, who's going to be the first one to launch a satellite, who's going to be the first person to send a people into space, who's going to be the first to the moon. I mean, we never would have had an Apollo program without the Cold War. Sputnik was an incredible shock. It was one of the best things that ever happened to the American educational system because, you know, it led to a lot of support for better mathematics and science teaching and financial support. I mean, I was supported in graduate school by the National Science Foundation, and that started partly because of Sputnik. But then also, of course, there was the personal adventure of going out to our high school football field. My dad took a few friends and me out there. And of course, all the newspapers would publish here's when Sputnik is going to fly over. And you know, one of my friends was an amateur radio operator, and he actually received the beep, beep, beep from Sputnik and got his picture in the local newspaper. I mean, nowadays, nobody pays any attention when satellites fly over. You see them all the time. But to go out there and see this thing moving across the sky, and it was going really fast, and it wasn't blinking like an airplane. So, you know, there really was something new under the sun, and that was incredibly exciting. Of course, I was only in middle school at the time, but I still understood enough to understand what it meant to be in orbit around the Earth and, you know, why you needed rockets to get up above the atmosphere and so on. So it was definitely motivating that we knew this. For me, space exploration was the future. It represented the future. And that's one reason why I was so excited about it.
Yeah, yeah. And Jeff, the telescope that you talked about, were there many astronomers in your life, like to make the steps for you to study that and go on to do a PhD? I mean, I presume like your family were supportive of you, but was it an easy thing for you to imagine, or was it a massive leap?
It was very interesting because as an undergraduate, I did do a degree in astronomy and physics, but the astronomers at the universities where I was studying, I mean, they were doing kind of classical astronomy, studying double stars. And I think there was one person doing radio astronomy, but nobody was thinking about high energy astrophysics at the time. I mean, some people were in other places, but it was, I still though, had read enough. And when I was looking for graduate school, there was a group at Harvard University that was flying telescopes up in balloons to look at gamma rays. And again, for me, this was new and exciting. And so that was one of the reasons why that's where I went and I joined that group. And from gamma rays, I went, while I was a graduate student, Ken Pounds, who was the professor who led the X-ray astronomy group at Leicester University, came over to Cambridge, Massachusetts to spend summers, and I had met him. And he was a very personable guy. And when I finished my graduate study, I had a fellowship that allowed me to go for a year and study anywhere in the world. So I contacted Ken and he said, yeah, come on over to Leicester. And I did. I was a little bit concerned that, you know, my impression of English universities were pictures of the Oxford Dons and everybody.
Yeah, like Hogwarts kind of places, yeah.
But our group at Leicester, I mean, maybe it was the American influence that Ken had picked up, but, you know, everybody was on first name basis and it was very informal and it was a very friendly group, but it was, from a scientific point of view, absolutely world class. And so it was a great experience. And that's really what started my astronomy career. And I owe a great, thanks to not only Ken, but the technicians and my fellow scientists at Leicester who really helped me get started.
Yeah. And then before we move on then to your astronaut career, were you always a curious child? Was science very easy for you? Did you grow up in an environment where that was encouraged or were you different? What was that like?
No, I was very fortunate. I mean, my parents were both well-educated. We had a you know, we were always reading books, talking about new discoveries. And so it was really expected that I was going to do well in school. I mean, they recognized that I was basically intelligent. I always liked to work. I never had a problem getting my homework done. I was pretty easy to raise. I mean, they never had to pay attention to whether I was, doing something else but other than my schoolwork. And I always got encouragement. I always remember when I announced to my parents that I was applying to be an astronaut, first thing my mother said was, "Oh, that's too dangerous," which she always worried. But my father basically said, "Yeah, that makes sense," because he knew my personality, because not only was I interested in scientific things, but, you know, physically I skied, I climbed mountains, and I was always looking for new challenges. And the idea of actually becoming an astronaut and going up into space, of course, at that point, it was just a dream. It was, the chance of actually getting selected is pretty small. But nevertheless, if you don't try, you're never going to have a chance. And so I tried. And fortunately, I was one of the lucky people who did get selected.
What do you think were your what do you think that you have that set you apart from so many of the other thousands of applicants?
Well, of course, from a technical point of view, I had the right qualifications. I mean, I had excellent marks in school. I had experience with space activities. I worked in a laboratory, flying balloons and sounding rockets. I'd gotten my hands dirty with electronics. I could work computers. But, so did hundreds of other people. I also had some good stories to tell. One of the most critical parts of the astronaut selection process is the personal interview. And I've been on astronaut selection panels, and I know how difficult it is because so many qualified people come in and we interview them. And at the end of the day, you sort of look through, who have we talked to today? Who do we want to carry through to the next round of selection? And as I said, I had some good stories to tell. Some of them actually came from my experience back as a student when I was doing mountaineering and sport parachuting. I had, one instance where my parachute didn't open properly, and I had to make a very quick decision. Should I take a chance and ride it down to the ground and risk breaking my leg, or should I cut it away and count on my reserve parachute opening, which is in fact what I did, and it worked. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been there to tell the story. And then over in Leicester, I actually got involved with, I had learned back at Harvard, I had learned from a wonderful professor there, Francis Wright, who had been teaching celestial navigation to generations of students ever since the Second World War. And as an astronomer, I had always been fascinated by the idea of using the stars for navigation. It seemed like the one useful thing that you could really do with astronomy. And I also liked sailing. A friend of one of the my technician friends at Leicester had purchased a 110-foot old Norwegian coastal steamer, the Stavanger. And when I mentioned that I knew how to navigate, I got taken on as the ship's navigator, and we had various trips over to the Netherlands, a beautiful trip to the Norwegian fjords. And so I had some good stories to tell and keep the astronaut selection panel amused and interested. And so I assume that at the end of the week, when they were doing their review, that guy with the parachutes and the ocean, I remember him. He seemed pretty good. That's, you'd to go any deeper than that, you'd have to ask the selection panel.
Yeah, but still, I think it is that thing, though. I mean, like, I'm getting a sense from you, you know, you're somebody that always was just curious, and you just sort of, you know, embrace life. If you're interested in something, you just pursued it. There was nothing really that kind of got in your way.
Anytime I get a chance for a new experience, almost always I'll take advantage of it. I mean, life is short. And the more of it you can experience, the richer your life is. I've been very fortunate. I've gotten to do a lot of different things.
Yeah, but it's essentially, I think it's also a way of life that kind of gets you to do the interesting things. In a way, it's sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can talk about luck, and I've certainly been lucky in the sense that I've had many opportunities, but you know, part of being lucky is to recognize when an opportunity presents itself and then take advantage of the opportunity. You know, how many opportunities pass by that people never realize. And then they say, you know, why am I not so lucky? So, yeah, you always have to be on the lookout for, are there things that I could do that I haven't done yet? And then take advantage of it. And of course, I have built up over the years a skill set where a lot of these opportunities were technical, and I had the technical background where I could take advantage of them.
Yeah, but you were doing it for the love of it. You know, I don't think, you know, I think sometimes the message with astronaut selection is that people do things because it's kind of, it's another thing to tick off a box, but it's very genuine and very sincere from you that you're just a curious person and you just embrace life and you have this, you know, you just devour information and you embrace lifelong learning.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times you know, students will come up to me and say, you know, I really want to be an astronaut. Should I learn how to fly an airplane? And my answer is, you know, look, you know how many tens of thousands of people apply to be astronauts? And no matter how qualified you are, the chance of getting selected is pretty small. If you and frankly, learning how to fly, it's a big investment in time and money. Look, if you want to learn how to fly, it's great. Go do it. But don't do it just because you think it'll help you be an astronaut. The same thing, you know, I didn't jump out of airplanes because I wanted to be an astronaut. I jumped out of airplanes because I wanted to know what it was like falling through the air.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was a lot of fun. And I kept doing it. But, you know, who knows? It, as I said, it gave me a really nice story to tell when I went in for my astronaut selection. But I did it because I loved it.
I think that's essentially it. I think if you're kind of, it's like, it's never about the destination. It's always about the journey, you know, and as you say, like, if you embrace your life, who knows where you're going to go, but you're going to have a great time along the way. And as you say, you're just aware of opportunities as they arise, you know? So
if you enjoy flying an airplane,
exactly,
or jumping out
of
airplanes, even if you don't get selected as an astronaut, you're still doing something that you enjoy doing. And that's why you should be doing it.
That's it. I think that's so true. It's so true. So Jeff, then, you know, your career with NASA as an astronaut on the space shuttle program, and, you know, five amazing flights, 50 days logged, you know, so the very first launch, I guess, you know, do you ever get used to it? Does it ever become, I mean, it can't possibly ever become, oh yeah, here we go again. I'm sure it's very exciting. But just in your body, do you ever get used to launch? And I know re-entry is easier with the space shuttle compared to like the Soyuz and how some other capsules return. But launch in particular, do you ever get used to that in your body?
Well, there's two things about getting used to it. First of all, there's the launch itself, which is pretty overwhelming. I mean, there's shaking and vibration. The big difference between the first flight and all the other flights is I didn't know what to expect. I mean, people told me, look, imagine as much vibration and noise as you possibly can, and it's going to be more than that. And sure enough, they were right. I mean, there was so much shaking and vibration. The first 2 minutes of the shuttle, because you have those two big solid rockets burning, and there's a tremendous amount of turbulence inside them, so you're really shaking. And at one point, particularly about a minute into the flight, you go through the sound barrier And it shakes even more. And I thought to myself, this can't be normal. I mean, the wings are going to fall off or something like that. But of course, I mean, intellectually, I knew that the shuttle had flown a few times before and the wings never fell off. And so probably they weren't going to fall off this time. And sure enough, they didn't. All of my other four flights, I mean, it was just as violent, but I knew what to expect. What I was really curious about, though, you know, my first flight actually turned out it was a remarkable flight, because originally first of all, I should mention that I was originally supposed to fly in June of 1984 with a particular payload. But back in those days, flights kept getting canceled and crews got moved from one flight to another. And we got moved from that flight to another flight to another flight. And finally, on the fourth time, we finally launched in April of 85 with a completely different flight, where we were just supposed to launch two satellites and then come home. But one of those satellites didn't turn on. And it turned out there was a little switch on the outside of the satellite, which was the only thing that we had access to. And NASA decided, nobody really thought that they were going to go ahead and do this, but they decided to send my partner and me out on an unplanned spacewalk. The first time in NASA's history that they had ever done an unplanned, what we call a contingency spacewalk, in an attempt to fix the satellite. And that really changed my life, because, I mean, again, you talk about getting lucky and taking advantage of it, but I did a good job. And, you know, people told me when I got back, hey, you look good in a spacesuit. And after that, I started getting assigned to developing new spacesuits and became one of the EVA or spacewalking cadre in the office. And so when it was time to choose a crew for the Hubble space mission, and they said, well, only people who have done spacewalks before can do spacewalks for Hubble, because it was so critical, and I was lucky to get selected. But going back to my first flight, so we ended up staying in space for 7 days, and I got pretty used to zero gravity and floating around. Then my next flight was supposed to be in March of 1986, which was an astronomy flight. We were taking several ultraviolet telescopes up. That would have been the very next flight after the Challenger disaster. And so, we were close to the crew, because we were the very next flight. We knew them all personally and their families. That's a whole other story. But all the flights were canceled, and I didn't fly again until December of 1990. So 5.5 years later. And I wondered, would I still remember what it was like floating around in space? And amazingly, the first day I was up in space on my second flight, it felt like the eighth day of my first flight. My body really remembered what it was like. And that was a wonderful feeling.
After you come down, does the sense, like if you're asleep with that feeling of that sensation of microgravity when you're there, do you, when you're asleep, do you sometimes think you're still floating in the space shuttle?
I wish.
You wish, yeah.
One of my friends who had been on a flight before my first flight told me, hey, look, Jeff, the first night that you go to sleep, lie very quietly on your bed and don't move. And if you're really lucky, you'll get a sense that you're floating again, that you're back in space. And do it the first night, because it's never going to come back. And he was right. I did have that experience. And unfortunately, it doesn't come. I wish I could recreate that feeling, because the feeling of weightlessness is, it's a whole new dimension of existence. I remember talking about it once. I was at a conference in Paris. It was a combination of science and philosophy. And there was a Jesuit priest there, and I was talking about the wonder of weightlessness and the sense of freedom of the human body that you never experience anywhere else. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, You know, in theology, we would call that a state of grace. And that's what it sounded like to him that I was describing. And everybody who comes back, you know, we share that experience. I'm delighted now that more and more people are going to have a chance to share that, because it's a whole new experience for human consciousness that it really made me realize, you know, if this is such a new experience, you know, there are so many other things that the human mind and body are potentially capable of. And of course, that went along with my desire for new experiences. You know, anybody who goes scuba diving for the first time or skydiving for the first time, again, it's a totally new experience and exciting. But going into space and being weightless is maybe an order of magnitude more extraordinary than any of those things.
Yeah, I did a parabolic flight in Moscow about four years ago. And, you know, you only have 30 or 40 seconds of weightlessness. And you were describing it yesterday in the lectures.
It's still brilliant.
Yeah, it really is fantastic. It was very confusing. I kept holding on to the bar. And it was only that night I went, why did I hold on to the bar? But you immediately want to move your body, because it just moves in a completely different way. And I just never stopped laughing. I just couldn't stop laughing the whole time it was happening, because it was so like that. It was very liberating. And you're right. You're communicating with your body in a completely new way. And I can only imagine what it's like if you get to do that for a sustained period of time, what you find out what your body is capable of. And of course, for people who are in pain or who have, you know, who have muscular problems or whatever, I can only imagine that all that pressure of gravity is just gone.
I've been on, of course, they had that incredible flight where they took Stephen Hawking on a parabolic flight, and he said it was the most extraordinary, liberating experience of his life, you know, after being confined to a wheelchair for decades. And actually, there's a organization in the U.S. now which is promoting and has actually carried out parabolic flights for people specifically with physical disabilities. My last parabolic flight, I flew with a blind person, and she was we were very interested. How would she be able to orient herself in space without being able to see? Because, you know, all of your internal organs, which tell you what's up and down, don't work anymore. And she said it was a totally unique experience, but she said she felt more lost than she had ever felt in her entire life, because she, of course, she was used to not being able to see, but she had gotten so used to, you know, the feeling of the ground under her feet and, you know, the vestibular organs in your inner ear. And when that went away, and she didn't have the sense of vision that most of us do to orient ourselves. And so I can imagine that it was a remarkably disorienting experience.
That's incredible, isn't it? Because I guess for her, it's like, you know, gravity for her is like her compass. Gosh, that's amazing.
But she loved it, by the way. She said, yes, it was very disoriented, but you know, she'd do it again in a heartbeat.
And so you were fine. You didn't get any sinus problems or headaches, or your stomach was okay, or how did you?
I was quite fortunate. You know, I don't have a very strong stomach for, you know, going up in the NASA jets, and we'd go out and do aerobatics. And I'd often get, you know, airsick when we started doing aileron rolls for 5 minutes at a time. It turns out that there is no correlation between susceptibility to air sickness, seasickness on the Earth, and space sickness. I've seen, you know, what we call iron-bellied pilots who can go up and do aileron rolls all day, and they go up in space and get sick as a dog. But on the other hand, it's not anti-correlated. I mean, there's plenty of people who get sick on the ground and they get sick in space, or who don't get sick, and so on. But the nice thing is almost everybody gets over that feeling of space sickness after, you know, 1 or 2 days. And almost everybody who comes back will tell you that the experience of weightlessness you know, they forget about the first day or two where they were accommodating, and what they remember is the joyous feeling of freedom, of being able to move around in a way that you've never been able to do before. I mean, you push off the wall and you're Superman flying through the air. You know, I showed a picture to my two sons, who were little kids at the time, you know, a picture from a parabolic flight. Oh, look, there's Daddy flying through the air like Superman. It was great. I wish I had a cape.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, it's lovely. I was at the Astronautical Congress in 2019. And, you know, there's these filmmakers called Felix and Paul Studios, and they're working very closely with NASA to create, very visual experiences. I think they're actually going to be filming the launch, the Artemis launch, when it happens. But they had on display like a limited, about 3 minutes of work that they had done with 360 cameras to create what it felt like on the International Space Station. And you really felt that you were floating. I mean, so I hope that with VR, you know, with virtual reality, while not everybody can afford it, I think to have that sensation in your body, even if it's kind of simulated with VR, I think it can give people that state of grace that maybe you talked about, which would be great.
I my last parabolic flight that I was just mentioning, I actually was doing an experiment using virtual reality. And I actually was looking at a scene of floating through the space station while I was floating for 20 seconds in the parabolic plane. And it was remarkable how that brought back to me the feeling of really being in space. I mean, even more so than just floating in the parabolic airplane, the combination of the visual sense, it was extraordinary.
Yeah. So, Jeff, we have to talk about, you know, your mission to repair the Hubble, because it's exceptional for lots of different reasons. I mean, is it still the record for, you know, orbiting as far the furthest away on a mission, or did Inspiration 4?
No, they went further out.
Yeah.
We went as far up as the shuttle was capable of doing. We wanted to put Hubble as high up above the Earth as possible, to get it above as much of the atmosphere as we could, so that it didn't interfere with its pointing capability. But that was as high as the shuttle.
It was about 800 miles orbit, was it?
It was about 600 kilometers.
600 miles. 600 kilometers. 400 miles. So you were, I've asked you all that every time. I think I'm at a session where you talk, I always ask you to share your experiences of it, because it's very different from you know, the missions of people that are in, you know, a lower Earth orbit around 300 kilometers, because of course you're more exposed to cosmic rays and any sort of solar storms and stuff that happen.
We got about 10 times the radiation of a normal shuttle crew. I mean, nothing that was dangerous, but they did special radiation monitors on us because we were, you know, sort of scratching the surface of the inner Van Allen radiation belts. I've actually been fortunate in that respect, because I was on the highest shuttle flight, which was Hubble. On my third flight, which was the one just before Hubble, the last 2 days of the flight, we took the shuttle down as low as it could go and still stay in orbit, because they wanted to study the interaction of atomic oxygen with the skin of the shuttle. And what it did was it interacts with the skin of the shuttle and causes the entire shuttle to glow. It was the most extraordinary thing. I mean, it was like sort of like St. Elmo's fire, but over the entire shuttle. I mean, the wings, the tails, everything was glowing bright orange. It was surrealistic. So yeah, I've been as high and as low as the shuttle could go. I was very fortunate.
And your EVA, or your spacewalk to repair the Hubble, what was that like? What do you remember most about that
well,
day?
Well, everybody knows about the optical problems that,
yes,
had, that we went to fix. But actually, there were about a dozen things that had to be fixed. There was also a problem with the solar arrays. There were the two magnetometers had both failed. And then a bunch of electronic boxes were having problems or had actually failed. So there were so many things to do that when they actually set out to do a timeline, they realized it was going to take 5 days of spacewalking, which we had never done before. And of course, the shuttle could only stay up for about 11 days, which meant we had to do them one day after the other.
Exhausting, I'd say.
We had four spacewalkers rather than the normal two. So we had two teams so that you didn't have to go out 2 days in a row. I think we could have if we had had to, because we trained, we cross-trained with the other teams so that if anyone's spacesuit was having a problem or if they got sick or something, we could fill in for one another. But as it was, my partner, Story Musgrave, and I went out on days 1, 3, and 5, and then Tom Akers and Kathy Thornton went out on days 2 and 4. And it was such a complex mission. There were many people who really thought that NASA had bitten off more than they could chew, so to speak. And that, you know, because I still had a lot of friends in the astronomy community, I was constantly, as we were training for the flight, I'd get a call from an old astronomer friend. Hey, Jeff, can you guys really do this? And you know, I said, well, you know, we're going to try. And sure enough, it all worked.
It did. It did. It
was. I guess the most gratifying moment there was when on the third day of spacewalking, when we installed the new wide field camera, which had the optical corrections built in. And once we did that, we knew that no matter what else happened, hopefully Hubble would be able to see straight once again. Of course, the interesting thing was, I always remember after the fifth and final day of spacewalking, when we had completed every single task that had been set out for us, plus one additional one. We had to make some special covers for the magnetometers, because when we installed the new magnetometers on the third day, I noticed there was some paint peeling off and they were worried about contamination. So on the fourth day, Tom and Kathy brought in some insulating material from the payload bay, and we made special covers out of it. And then on the fifth day, Story and I installed those covers over the magnetometers. And that had never been planned beforehand. But when Story and I came in out of the airlock and we realized that, 5 days of spacewalking and we actually did it all. But we still didn't know whether the optical corrections, which had been designed, of course, by optical engineers and mechanical engineers, astronomers, and so on, was it really going to work? And you couldn't turn on the instruments that we had installed for a couple of weeks, because atmosphere, we had launched them from the Earth and there was atmosphere that sticks to the outside, and you have to wait until that atmosphere dissipates into the vacuum of space before you can turn on the high voltage. Otherwise, you'll create sparks and destroy your electronics. So it was New Year's Eve, and it was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning. We had had a party and I was cleaning up in the kitchen and the phone rang, and it was an old astronomer friend from the Space Telescope Institute in Baltimore, which was running the Hubble. And after wishing each other a new year, happy new year, he asked me if I had any champagne available, and we had a half bottle left in the refrigerator. He said, well, pour yourself a glass, because he said, we're really not supposed to tell anybody because NASA wanted to make a public announcement after the holiday, but they figured that somebody on the crew ought to know that they had gotten the first pictures back from Hubble, and it worked. And everybody knows now when I talk about Hubble, I tell people at the beginning, this is not a suspense story. You know how it turned out.
We
but
do.
Back then, we
Nobody
really
did.
How it was
yeah,
going to turn
of course.
Out. And of course, the whole, the disaster of, when it was recognized that Hubble couldn't focus properly, if you didn't live through that time, it's hard to remember what an absolute disaster it was for NASA, for the astronomical community. I mean, Hubble was the joke of late night comedians. It was denounced in the U.S. Congress as a techno turkey and so on. And And, you know, had we not been able to fix it, I think the future of NASA would have been very different. I'm not sure that Congress would have approved the International Space Station and so on. But luckily, everything worked. And, of course, the rest is history, because Hubble has gone on to rewrite astronomy books many times over. And it's just, you know, pictures from Hubble are in school classrooms all over the world. So, what a feeling of accomplishment to have been able to have been a part of that. And you know, as both an astronomer and an astronaut, to put my own two hands on the Hubble Space Telescope out in space, I mean, talk about the thrill of a lifetime. Wow.
Jeff, I can't, you know, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you're part of history forevermore. I mean, those images, as you say, inspired so many people, myself included, and they're deeply philosophical images. They're not just like, they go beyond astronomy. They go beyond the science of astrophysics. They inspire.
The pillars of creation, the birth of stars. I mean, let there be light. It's biblical.
It's biblical. It really is. And they touch people in ways that I think we can't even articulate sometimes. We just know that we're looking at something that has a meaning beyond our own existence, and we're part of it somehow. Like, there's this strong connection to those images. They're beautiful. They're just beautiful. It's incredible that you're, as you say, you touched the instrument, not only, you know, on Earth, but actually as it was orbiting Earth, you know, and then it goes on to give us so many more amazing things. I want to ask you one last question about Hubble, but I might ask, I'll leave it to the end, because I want to also talk about the amazing stuff that you're doing now. So not only were you involved in something like Hubble, but also Mars, being involved in Perseverance and the amazing MOXIE, that's one of the instruments on board Mars, which is showing us that we can take carbon dioxide and turn it into oxygen. Tell us a little bit about your involvement in that. And you know,
I was very fortunate to get involved in this program.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the principal investigator, it turns out, was one of my graduate students when I was teaching back at MIT before I went to NASA. So, you know, to see your students succeed, and now I'm sort of working for him in a sense. I'm the deputy principal investigator. I had never done anything with Mars. Of course, you know, the space shuttle went orbit around the Earth, and you know, we dream of going to Mars someday as humans, but I had never been involved in any Mars research projects. So this was an incredible opportunity when Mike Heck, the principal investigator, came and he said, you know, this is an experiment to produce oxygen, which ultimately we need for human exploration of Mars. And because of the human connection, maybe would I be interested in being the deputy principal investigator? And sure, this was an incredible opportunity. And the idea is that not only do you need oxygen to breathe, and, you know, of course, if I went to Mars myself, I would be very happy to have oxygen to breathe. But I only need about 800 or 900 grams of oxygen a day. But on the other hand, assuming that I want to come home to Earth, I need a big rocket to get me off the surface of Mars. And you know, rockets burn fuel and they need a lot of oxygen. In fact, 3/4 of the mass of the propellant of most rockets is oxygen. I reckon, you know, for a crew of 6, your rocket would need about 30 tons of oxygen. So that's a lot more than you breathe. And to take all that oxygen all the way from the Earth would be incredibly expensive. Now, you know, most of the stuff we send to Mars, we have to make on Earth. You know, anything that's manufactured, whether it's spacesuits or habitats or computers or whatever. I mean, we can't make those things on Mars. But dumb old oxygen, you know, you're going to spend billions of dollars to send 30 tons of oxygen to the surface of Mars if you can make that oxygen on Mars. And that's exactly what we're doing with MOXIE, because it turns out that Mars does have an atmosphere. It's very thin. It's about 1% of the atmosphere density here on Earth, but it does have an atmosphere, which is almost entirely carbon dioxide, which is CO2. And there you go, O2, oxygen. And so what MOXIE does, it uses electrochemistry to Just like, in high school chemistry, just about everybody who takes chemistry electrolyzes water. You know, you put two electrodes in water, you hook it up to a battery, and voila, hydrogen bubbles up on one side and oxygen bubbles up on the other side. Well, it turns out you can electrolyze carbon dioxide just as well. It's a lot more difficult. You have to heat it up to about 800 Celsius, and you have to run it over special catalysts and special type of electrolyte. But you can do it. And it had been demonstrated many times in laboratories on Earth to develop this process. But NASA has a principle that if you have a critical process or piece of equipment that is going to be used someday in a future mission, you have to demonstrate it in its actual environment, which means you got to do it on Mars. And that was the purpose of MOXIE, was to demonstrate that Mars doesn't have any nasty surprises. And so what we are attempting to do is to operate MOXIE under all Martian conditions, because the Mars atmosphere is much more variable than the Earth. Just day to night, you can get 100-degree variation in temperature. And between the summer and the spring and the winter, the density of the atmosphere can change by a factor of two. So we want to operate MOXIE in all seasons and all times of day. And that's what we're doing so far. It's run successfully 9 times. We're getting ready, I hope, to run it a 10th time. And it's been extremely successful. It's validated the process. And I like to think that someday when I don't know when it's going to be, but when people finally do get to Mars, they're going to have the great-great-grandchild of MOXIE making oxygen so they can
absolutely
get back home.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's really exciting to prove it and to show that it is actually possible. As you say, it means that we can get home, and also we can stay alive when we're there. It's like an essential building block. So that's fantastic that you're involved in that. I'm aware of time, and we're coming to the end of our amazing conversation. Thank you so much for it's just been brilliant. But Jeff, one last thing. So you've been on spacewalks, and I guess I think that's probably the most freeing point of view that you could have from Earth. So, you know, I've been lucky to talk to other astronauts, and I've asked them that same question of what Earth looks like from a distance. But from the cupola, for most of them, few of them have had the opportunity to describe it from an EVA. But you had the opportunity to describe it from an EVA or a spacewalk further away, but also holding on to the Hubble at the same time. Did any of that go in at that time? And if so, can you describe what that moment was like, and what looking down on Earth as you're floating in space, what does that feel like in a spacesuit?
Well, there's no question. I mean, the windows of the shuttle were great. The cupola is great. But when you go out there in a space helmet, all of a sudden, it's the closest experience of actually being in space. I mean, to hold my hand in front of my face and realize that there's a vacuum between my nose and my fingers, that's extraordinary. It's really an experience of being in space. The most extraordinary part of that was when we were up working on the magnetometers, because we were on the end of the robotic arm, 15 meters, 50 feet, away from the shuttle itself, working at the very top of the telescope. And I actually, the most extraordinary experience I had, of course, we're connected to the arm or to the shuttle by a stainless steel tether wires, so that, you know, we're not going to go floating away and get lost in space. But I wanted to see what it would feel like if I let go. Because as long as you're holding on,
yeah,
you know, if I push or pull, I'm reacting my force and I'm part of the shuttle, and because the shuttle is so much more massive than me. And so, again, I'm always looking for new experiences. I'm not going to do anything stupid. I didn't release my tether, but I set it so that it wasn't pulling on me. And I have to say, the first time I went to let go, I realized that I hadn't let go. There was something you know, deep in my psyche, which is saying, hey, you know,
you're going to fall. Yeah.
Down. It's a long way down. But
yeah.
You know, ultimately, the intellect triumphed and I did let go. And it was extraordinary. It truly was a psychological transformation. I was no longer part of the shuttle. I was an independent satellite floating in orbit, which from a physics point of view was absolutely true. I mean, you know, we're both going at 18,000 miles an hour around the Earth. And what was really extraordinary is I could turn my back so I couldn't see the shuttle. And it, particularly it was at night. And so it was just me floating there. And there were the stars above and the earth below. And, oh, man, I will never forget that moment. It was as the Jesuit priest said, it was a state of grace. I wish I could have stayed there for hours. But, of course, NASA doesn't send us up there so we can have existential experiences. They send us up so we can do useful work. And there was still plenty of work to do. So pretty soon I had to grab back on and you know, back to work. But that moment has stayed with me for the rest of my life, and I'll never forget it.
No, and thank you for sharing it with us. I mean, I can see it in my mind's eye when you describe it. I can only imagine what it's like. And I hope that you dream of that, because that's really beautiful. So from that telescope, from a very young age, I thank that telescope in New York. And if I'm ever in New York, I'll go find it, because it's amazing the person that it inspired. And thank you so much, Jeff, for sharing just a snippet of an amazing life experience so far. And the very best of luck on MOXIE and all things. And sure, I'll see you soon again, I'm sure, on the next Space Studies program.
Been a pleasure talking. Best wishes to all the listeners. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Humans of Space podcast from the makers of BBC Sky Night magazine. For more of our podcasts, head to skynightmagazine.com or search for us on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or your usual podcast provider.